The reason, of course, why we press this point is because what's happening at the Lord's Supper, it only makes sense if we realize that the primary actor is God, who in Christ and by the Spirit now wants to sustain us and feed us. My question is, how often should we do this? I started down this line a couple of minutes ago. Let me keep going. There are times in my life when I feel desperately the need for God's grace because I'm in over my head. And there are times in my life when I basically I'm managing. I can do this. I can teach on this subject. I can manage this organization. I can raise these funds. I can be a good wife, or pardon me, a good husband to Joella, my wife. I can manage all of this. And there are times in which I realize that my need for God's grace is intense, and not just intense, it's something I almost feel desperate for. What I have learned in my own journey of faith is that in those seasons of the year, I want to be, and I need to be, at the table frequently. My own journey as a Christian, and also as a pastor, has led me to the conclusion that I want to celebrate more frequently. And I referenced John Calvin. I could also reference John Wesley. Calvin argued for weekly celebration of the Lord's Supper. But the Council of Geneva, the city fathers, and they were fathers, not mothers, the city fathers, decreed that the Lord's Supper would only be celebrated once a quarter. Churches could only celebrate four times a year. Zwinglian influence. I have been told, but I have not found the documentable reference, so this is just tentatively offered, but I have been told recently that what Calvin did, and I would love to know if this is true, that what Calvin did was, because there were enough congregations and parishes and churches throughout Geneva, that what he did was persuade each church to celebrate on a different Sunday, with the argument that then, all things being equal, a person could have the option of celebrating the Lord's Supper each Sunday. They would just have to go church to church to church in order to do so. That goes back to being politically savvy or something, I don't know. But I'd love to know if that's true. What I do know is that Calvin lost the vote. He lost the vote, and the Council of Geneva declared, influenced by Zwingli and Zurich, that indeed they would only celebrate the Lord's Supper four times a year.
Actually, it's stronger than that. So he says he calls the people to celebrate at least weekly.
At least, which leads me then to John Wesley, precisely. Wesley celebrated twice a week, every Sunday and every Thursday. And it was a practice within Anglican Church of England parishes in the 18th century that at noon, every Thursday, every Anglican parish would have an observance of the Eucharist. And Wesley, as an itinerant evangelist, would always plan his schedule accordingly. He celebrated twice a week. And you see references to this in his magnificent little sermonette. It's more of a sermonette than a sermon, because it's not an exposition of text. It's his wonderful exposition entitled The Duty of Constant Communion, in which he has, in my estimation, one of the most powerful and compelling calls to regular participation in the Lord's table. Yes?
If I remember correctly, Calvin said that every time the church comes together, the Lord's Supper must be celebrated. So,
and I don't think
together midweek, that means the part of the essential nature of the church coming together is the Lord's Supper.
Is the Lord's Supper. How could we live without this? How could we be the church without this? I do read him at that point as saying, he is referring to the gathering for the Holy Liturgy, which typically would be once a week. But it doesn't discount the possibility of more frequent. But that sequence from Calvin to Wesley is not an incidental one, because the Book of Common Prayer really is Calvin. Mm-hmm. That is, if you want to know where is Calvin's theology of the Lord's Supper finding expression, it's not within Reformed churches, it's not within Presbyterian churches, it's within Anglican churches, ironically. That is, you can see a direct line between Calvin and Cranmer and the Book of Common Prayer and the move towards weekly celebration. So I quoted Calvin earlier, feed on him in your hearts by faith. Pardon me, I quoted the Book of Common Prayer earlier, feed on him in your hearts by faith, but that kind of language goes straight back to Calvin. So the irony for me is if you want to find Calvin's theology of the Lord's Supper in practice, you look to Wesley. Is that not cool or what? I think it's very cool. That is, Wesley's theology of the Lord's Supper is really deeply Calvinian. And for me, the irony or the tragedy or the however we want to phrase it or word it, the traditions that view themselves as heirs to either Calvin or Wesley here on this continent, on the whole, tend to be ambiguous and feel an ambiguity about the sacraments, not realize how deeply sacramental both Calvin and Wesley were. But why does Wesley say in the duty of constant communion, why does Wesley say that constant communion is necessary? And it all goes back to this. We need this grace. We cannot live except by the means of grace. We are in over our heads. And so, in my own journey, I have moved from once a month to once a week. When I was the pastor of Union Church of Manila, which is an interdenominational congregation in the Philippines, we had, under my predecessor, twice removed, under a Baptist, American Baptist, Alex Arroyo, American in the denominational designation sense. He also is American. But American Baptist Alex Aronis, he's the one who established the Thursday noon communion service. And I became the pastor and just kind of inherited this practice that had been done by Alex Aronis and then Daryl Johnson before me. And then I would design my weekly routines and activities around the Thursday noon hour communion service. And if I was gone, I didn't like it, but one of my colleagues and associates would preside, but I was a senior pastor, so I got the default. If I was in town, I got to preside at the Thursday communion service. And this was meant to be in following, in a sense, the practice that had been observed by Wesley himself. And this congregation was in downtown Manila. We're in the office business center of Makati in Metro Manila, if you know the city. And so the office towers are all around the building. And the service would start at 12:10 and finish at 12:50. So it was a 40-minute service. It included a 5-minute homily. It included a very simple rubric and liturgy by which we would institute and consecrate the elements and invite people to come. And typically we would have 50 to 60 people who would come out of their offices, eating their lunches, you know, half their sandwich on their way and half their sandwich on the way back to the office, or choosing to fast, but joining us for weekly communion. And I realized, where else would I want to be but on Thursday noon to be at in our sanctuary and to be part of not just presiding but participating in the celebration of the Lord's Supper. That was in Manila, where I got into the habit of celebrating the Lord's Supper twice a week on the first Sunday of the month, in our services, and then also on Thursday. But then, coming back to Canada back in 1991, on more than one occasion, I was either on retreat or in circumstances in my life that were filled with deep and profound stress. And on a couple of those occasions, once I was on retreat in Guelph, Ontario, and one of the gifts that is given to us at that Loyola House there in Ontario is that you're on a silent retreat in an Ignatian model, in Ignatian structure, but daily Eucharist is offered. And I had a season of my life when I was quite low, and I was in New York City. And I was staying at St. Paul's House, or Paulist House, on the corner of 59th Street and 9th Avenue, just by the Lincoln Center. And it's daily Eucharist at 8 a.m. And I just kind of asked if I could go. And they said, the less we know, the better. And that suited me just fine. So don't ask, don't tell. It's one of those kind of categories. I know that's very big down south of the border. So you are welcome. St. Paul's House, and for reference purposes, it's really an exquisite event of worship. If you're in Manhattan, and for what it's worth, I find Manhattan to be one of the most spiritually vibrant parts of this continent. And maybe I come from Vancouver, which is about as spiritually empty and vacuous as you can get. So the Pacific Northwest, from Seattle up to Vancouver, this is dry terrain. We get along quite fine without God, thank you. And we're very spiritual, but it's more Buddhist and Wiccan and other kinds of stuff than it is Christian faith. It's very hard to find a spiritual director in Vancouver. So the contrast between Vancouver and Manhattan for me is quite stunning. The number of vibrant, vital congregations in Manhattan is just simply and powerfully encouraging. And it's not just Tim Keller and so on. There's so many, I don't even know where to begin to list them. And it's happening on the Roman side as well. And one of the places you'll find deep hospitality is if you're in New York City and you would like to participate in the Lord's Supper more frequently than once a month, once a quarter, or even once a week, is to go to St. Paul the Apostle. 8 o'clock, the service lasts from 8 to 8:25. And you're welcome. And I began to realize that there are seasons in my life in which daily participation in the Lord's Supper would not be inappropriate. That is, that it was meeting my manna needs for the day. That is, I'm not suggesting that we would always celebrate the Lord's Supper daily. But what I am grateful to is those communities that make it available so that at those seasons of my life when that is the need, I have some place where I can go. And as a rule, it's going to be within Roman Catholic communities and settings. Ideally, those that have a hospitality that recognizes that your presence trumps whatever the local bishop thinks would be appropriate or not. I say all of those words advisedly. I would value knowing your own thoughts, your own take on the whole question of frequency, both your own experience, your own journey, but also just where your convictions have come and where they are perhaps going.
One of the course projects that I did when I was a student here was the frequency of communion. I served in a non-denominational church, Bible church, that had Reformed influences, so we communed quarterly. And I felt, from study of conviction, to try to address that.
So the try to address it.
To address that, yes. In the congregation. I'd been there for a couple of decades at that point, so there was some trust relationship already established that I could at least do a study with them.
Where I come from, it would take 3 decades, but I'm glad to know that you had this.
So I did a formative reflection with about 25 people using Wesleyan quadrilateral based on what Constance Cherry was using in her class at that point in time here on campus, and had them study scripture, theology, history, tradition, capital T, small t, and experience regarding communion. This was about a 6-week adult Sunday school class study.
Wow.
Long story short, came to the end of that period, and so I didn't implode the information upon them. I gave them the material and asked them to study and make conclusions. So each week we would they would summarize what they had learned during the week and prayed over during the week. So, long story short, came to the end, and I said, what should we do? And turned them loose in small groups again, and all of them concluded that we should commune weekly. One man, who was a strong conservative Baptist background, didn't agree with that.
No.
He was the one person that... just after that, you left the church, so...
I'm sorry.
But they also said that the church isn't ready for this, though. So it's recommended to the Board of Elders that they study the material we've studied and recommend that they move to increase communion to once a month. The next Sunday, this man who had disagreed apologized to the class said, I prayed this week and I was wrong.
Oh my.
My
Baptist that changed their minds. Sorry.
He moved. He left. He wasn't Baptist anymore.
Go ahead. That was something.
It was an altar call kind of thing. He just said that I was, it was a knee-jerk reaction to my tradition and my background. So, longer story shorter, we did just that. I presented the material to...
By the way, I don't think this needs to be short. I think the story you're telling is interesting to all of us. Yeah. So don't...
Okay.
The whole story, I think, interests us.
Okay. So I presented this material then over a period of perhaps 3 months, which may have been three meetings with the Board of Elders. So they, I basically condensed the conclusions of the group into notes, into a handout for the elders to review, and simply shared the conclusions and shared the recommendation that these congregants had made. And they agreed and voted to increase the observance of the table to monthly. So we moved from four times a year to 12 times a year, plus Maundy Thursday, Christmas Eve, and quarterly agape meals that I instituted at the same time. So we increased it to what, I don't know what the math is now, we're up to 16 and 18 times a year or more. So that's just one example of how if people are given the opportunity. And Scripture doesn't speak explicitly about frequency, nor does history. Theologians obviously allude to it, but so it, I couldn't implode, but we looked at Calvin, we looked at Wesley, and I simply said, you need to just pray about this, and gave them some articles to read and some excerpts from some authors, and it was really... really amazing to see them study on their own during the week and then share feedback in small groups and have them unanimously come to the conclusion that we need to commune more often. So that was one of the projects that I did in my matriculation here at the university that just really speaks also to the fact that this kind of study at IWS is not only personally transformative, but when we take this back to our home settings and introduce our people to it, that it becomes a transformative in the local community.
But I like the way, the reason why I'm interested in your story is partly because of the process. So it wasn't your coming back from the IWS in Jacksonville saying, I've gone down there, you lucky people, I have this extraordinary insight, let me tell you what you should be doing, and start using the word should. But you facilitated a process where you obviously had some convictions about it, but you let the process itself play itself out in a way that allows the Spirit to be the teacher. We may be planting the seeds, but to let it emerge at its own pace. And I appreciate even that God oftentimes is not in a big hurry to bring about God's ideal purposes. So maybe 12 is fitting and appropriate within that context. What we did in response to a similar process in my first parish was when everybody kept saying, everybody will reject going beyond, we were once a month, and if you add one more time, that's just going to be just, everybody will consider this. We had a morning and an evening service, and so I just asked the elders, where they basically thought the evening service, you can do anything you like, how about on the third Sunday of the month, we have communion in the evening service? And they just said, oh yeah, sure, you can do it, because in the evening you can do anything you want. Well, suddenly we doubled. From one Sunday to the next, we doubled the frequency with which we observed. And then also on all the kind of what we might term the feast days or the special feast days, to add those as well. But we were able to just double with one swoop without any political fallout, because somehow the evening service wasn't viewed as you can do anything you like there. There was more latitude to the sacred hour of 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. Thank you for that.
What does the Lord's table become? In church history, because it's certainly not the New Testament, when does the Lord's table become removed from a gathering of people eating dinner and bringing out a loaf and wine and saying, we're doing this in remembrance? When does that become something that is blessed by a...
I'm not questioning the value of shared meals, but I am speaking very specifically about a symbolic gestural meal as instituted by Christ and affirmed by the church. And if the symbolic gestural meal is linked to a broader meal, fine,
sure,
good, but it's not essential that it do so. And it seems that the Corinthian experience suggests that when it was, it actually became complicated when it did. So fairly early on in the history of the church, it was separated from the ordinary meals and became the sacred meal. And on the whole, it was weekly for a long, it was available daily if not weekly, where the Roman Church went, and I Vatican II did not address this, and I don't know what can address it. But you even have some, like John O'Malley and others, are raising the question, how do you even raise the question? But right now, the Eucharist is not essentially an ecclesial act in the Roman Communion, because an ordained priest can celebrate the office, can celebrate the Eucharist all by, in its gender-specific language intentionally, himself, so that the daily Eucharist is something that he can serve to himself without reference to the body. This, for me, is inconceivable.
Yeah.
So that, and I think there are Roman theologians who get that, but don't know what's the reference point. So it is something that is shared, but my point yesterday about saying it has to be symbolic, not a shared meal, is because it needs to be unequivocal. There needs to be no doubt whatsoever that what's happening here is transcending heaven and earth, and it's not just between you and me. So I will press against, let's just have a meal together and call it the Lord's Supper. I think that ironically you will desacralize the created order, however much God has been gracious to the Quakers and to the Salvation Army. So how often, if we're going to do it symbolically, and it is a symbolic gesture, how often should that happen?
I think in the Baptist context that I'm in, he was talking about it, and with the one guy that was deeply opposed to doing it more often. Well, that's kind of where I would be. And they were... this is something that happens a lot with Baptists. A lot of the things we talk about. I did my project on just psalm use in worship. And when we started with a group of 12, they said, well, who cares? And they did have to learn and to study for 6 weeks on their own and talking about it. And it wasn't that they didn't care. It's just that they didn't know. And so where we come from with the Lord's Supper is that it has been exactly like you said yesterday. It's a funeral. I feel bad. Really bad, because of the things that I've done, I need to do better, and I need to do really good so that I can take this, and I may get struck or hit by a car on the way out because I took it, it's powerful juice. And so they've never had teaching from the pulpit or in a Sunday school class, or they do not teach on the Lord's Supper. Other than the fact that it's just a remembrance of Christ on the cross, and that's what it is, and you need to take
it really
fully.
Is. I mean, it's one-dimensional, shallow. And when I say shallow and one-dimensional don't necessarily go together, but it makes it one-dimensional. So part of my pushing for, or nudging for, more observance is done in tandem with the Holy Meal's agenda. The book, The Holy Meal, the agenda in part is to say, come, see the richness, see the diversity of meaning. So that oftentimes the pushback is to say, if we celebrate it more often, it will become less and less meaningful. And I want to argue, this is such a meaningful event that you couldn't possibly exhaust all of its meaning with 365 observances a year, let alone 12, or let alone 52.
I think in looking at it, I think they would come to the understanding. I think that, well, maybe this doesn't mean to me as much as I thought it did.
Yes.
Because it's even like in the Divine Embrace that Bob Weber wrote when he said, we live under the spirituality of somebody, three generations ago. And that's really what I see in at least my church and the people that I'm in fellowship with all the time, is that they say, well, this is why we do this, I think, because this is what...
But it is interesting, I mean, talking about Kent's process, it is interesting to me in my own setting. I suspect that the majority of lay people within Christian and Missionary Alliance churches would like more frequent observance. But there are the negative voices, the pushback, tend to be the minority, but nobody wants the meal to be divisive. And so until it's almost unanimous, we're not going to do it more frequently. And that's typical. Much decision making is made in congregations that way. Well, if there's somebody really opposed, we won't do it. Rather than to say, this seems to be of the Lord, we're moving in this direction. And I think if we were to do a similar study to what Kent did in most of our churches, that most lay people are ready to move here.
even the, if the theo, it's not the theologian saying you should do this more frequently, there's just this, what can I call it, felt need. That's not a very theologically informed phrase. There's this felt need that I am inclined to think is of the Spirit. I wonder if part of what's going to drive this is that as our societies, and I mean them plural, because the difference between Vancouver and Jacksonville and Calgary, these are three different cultures. But if we look at Sweden and the UK, but especially Sweden, because it's the furthest down the corridor, so to speak, in the secularization process, if that's where we're going to be, we would be wise to all, you know, have an edition of the IWS in Sweden, a field trip, to say, where is culture going to be in 15, 20 years, if they're a generation ahead of us? And if in an increasingly secularized society we need to be the church, what are the practices that will sustain our authenticity in a highly secularized environment? Because when people say to me, well, we've been observing the Lord's Supper just once a month for the last kind of like several centuries here, and we seem to be doing fine, one side of me wants to say, well, actually, you're not fine. You're deeply conflicted. The level of conflict within Alliance churches is pathological. It's pathological. We don't know how to address it. So no, you're not fine. But that's, you know, okay. You know, it looks to me like not like you're in but not of the world. It looks to me like you're not in the world and you are of it. Like we've got the reverse in going on here. But let's say you are fine. Let's say the church has survived with only monthly communion or quarterly. That's not where we're going to be. That is, we're moving in our society is moving in a direction that is an increasingly secularized one, which we can debate whether or not this is a good or a bad thing. It may not be inherently a bad thing for what it's worth. It may actually be a purification process for the church. Whether it's good or bad, bracketing that up, that's my contention is that that's where we're going. And Canada is about 5 years ahead of you, so you know, it's just watch us and see how we manage this. But as we become increasingly secularized, there's a church need to attend to recognize that the civil society that is around us is not going to sustain us. It's going to be antithetical to our deep core values and practices. And thus, we need to kind of bolster, you might say, the means of grace by which we are sustained. So my pushback has been to say, one, well, if we do it more frequently, it's going to diminish its value for us. I want to say no. The richness of this event cannot be exhausted. It's just so multidimensional rich that it can't be. And secondly, we may not be able to make it unless we appropriate every last means of grace that's been given to us, and particularly those that have been ordained by Christ. So I want to err on the side of frequency. So if you know, Kent's right, the scriptures are not explicit how frequently should we do this. It seems, you know, I mean, a pretty strong case can be made. Every time they gathered, they broke bread together. Well, okay, you know, it seems there. I mean, but it's not. It did say, "Thou shalt." So I'll grant it. The evidence seems to point that way than not. But if the Lord said to us, "Actually, I want it to be regular, but it's as often as you would like it to be," which way would we lean? Why would we not lean in the direction of where the greatest odds are that it will serve us well, sure, rather than away, is what I would be inclined to say. So nothing is lost by more frequency, and perhaps much is gained.
I think my thought, it's not necessarily pushback, it's just thinking through all
this. No, pushback's fine.
Over the last few years, Jesus did such a great job of taking the mundane and making it spiritual and mystical, mm-hmm, and exciting. And that's water for baptism, mm-hmm, bread and wine. But I think in the church at times we have taken the it's almost like we've done the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. Instead of allowing the mundane to just be spiritual, we have to make it spiritual so that it can eventually become mundane again. I don't know how else to put that, but it's almost like, and that's why that I don't personally gather my family together and we don't have corporate bread and wine like I was talking about earlier. That was just me thinking out loud. But,
sure.
But sometimes I wonder if there isn't some value necessarily in that a little bit. I think when I do gather with my family I see that picture of Jesus with the disciples and he pulls the bread out of the wine, but I don't think that was like he had it ducked under the table, and he was like, I'm saving this for a special occasion. And then when they all got together, he pulled it out. I think it was more organic than that. I think they were gathering together, and they're having some bread, and they already had wine, and he said, hey, I got a great idea.
I don't think he said, hey.
Well, maybe he did.
No.
He said, yeah, what would it be?
He gave a Canadian head. Yeah.
What would be the...
Oi.
That's just the idea.
The Hebrew equivalent. Yes.
Yeah, my experience was very different from Kent's.
From Kent's.
Very different. I was in the same context. I was a Baptist pastor, and you know, we did communion about once a month, and it was the very dismal, the blood songs. You know, that's where I grew up, and where I was a Southern Baptist in those days, and. I read this book that Bob Weber wrote, Evangelicals on the Canterbury Trail, and it totally upset my apple cart. And within 5 years, I was in the Anglican world, in the Episcopal Church.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
why did it upset you? Or upset the apple cart? Not upset you?
Everything. You know, I became an Anglican theologically from studying Cranmer. The main thing was, I'm an ESTJ under Myers-Briggs, so I was very structured, and I led a singles ministry of 150 people, and you know, everyone takes their notebook out and waits for you to expose the truths that they need to learn and apply, very didactic. So forth. Well, what happened is I had some trauma in my life. It was called a senior minister. And I was literally, none of it worked for me.
None of what worked?
None of the cognitive solutions for spirituality. Mm. I would go back and start out saying, well, I just need to do better. I need to forgive more. I should. It was the only resource I had going for me. You know, it was the cognitive piece. And someone invited me to an Episcopal church, and I went forward to receive communion, and I had this incredible mystical experience. And then went back, and somehow I sensed God bringing calmness and peace and affection to me. And it didn't take long until I said, you know, I'm in the wrong place. And so I made that dramatic change. I spent a year at the Presbyterian Church at the halfway house, you know, and then moved, you know, full tilt into the Episcopal world. And I could never go back. I don't reject it. I embrace it. But it was a place that I needed to move from. And so the frequency of communion, when you ask that question, my thought was, well, if you can't do it every day, you certainly should do it at least once a week. I just can't even imagine. I've been helping out at another parish during Advent. So 3 of the Sundays, I was subbing as the organist and choir master at another parish, which I normally don't do anymore because I want to stay at my parish where I was for 17 years. But for 3 Sundays, I didn't receive the Eucharist because I was in the back, up way away, and they didn't deliver it to me, which is what would happen if you were in my
church. Yes, be astute logistically here. And watch. Have your eyes, yes.
And
I actually ask, when I preside, have all received, and then
yes,
I stop.
Yes, in our church, the rector would do the same thing. They will bring it to you if you're not able to get out. But that never happened, and it was very hard for me to not receive. And so on the one Sunday, the second Sunday of Advent, when I was back in my parish doing the sermon there, it was a blessing to receive. And but this is not a cerebral thing. This is a heart thing and an experience, an encounter, a supernatural encounter with God that comes when I receive the Eucharist. And now it is a very common experience. Virtually every week it's like that. And it's like everything is displaced. I am with the community, and we go forward together, and we receive Christ. It's an incredible experience.
I'm delighted. And I, and God has called many on said trail. Some of us have been asked to stay back and not go on the trail and stay within our communions and be nudgers and encouragers. And there's both testimonials for me are significant indicators of the ways in which God may guide us differently for the sake of the good. Two things before we break for lunch. What about those in hospitals? What about those in prisons? What about those who can't because they're elderly and shut in or sick at home? I want to press, if it's not already the practice within the communions of which you're a part and the ministries that you have, that you think about them. That is, I understand that I don't question the value and power of going to the hospital as a chaplain and visiting with someone who's getting ready for surgery and praying with them and laying hands on them. Don't question this value. I don't question the value of going to the prison and as a chaplain visiting with the prisoner and praying for him that God would grant him grace or her grace in the midst of this difficult situation. Don't question that value at all. But what about the value of the celebration of the Holy Meal with those that are not able to gather with the assembly of God's people? Do we have a responsibility and a call to take this spiritual nourishment to them? And I'm obviously, you sense where I'm going. Why not? Why would it not behoove us? And I would even go so far as to say that every time you celebrate, it behooves you to ask, who could not have been here? Who did not have the option to be here because of the limitations of their physical or professional responsibilities? That is, who could not be here but is an inherent and an integral part of this body and who needs this spiritual nourishment as much as the rest of us? So that there's some mechanism by which, I would go so far as to say, of this same bread, of this same consecrated bread, of this same cup, it now we even advise, what I've done now, when I preside, I will mention who's not here, and just assure people we'll be heading to the hospital this afternoon, and usually it's hospital visits, and we'll be going there, and so you remember we mentioned them in our prayers, you'll be glad to know we're going to be taking the elements to them in the hospital. In my estimation, those people in those circumstances feel keenly their need for this grace. That it seems to me it should be built right into the liturgy or the order, the assumption that you do not merely come because not all can come. And so in those cases, Zacchaeus, we're coming to you even if you can't come to us.
Yeah, yes. We do that every Sunday. We have a team of lay Eucharistic ministers that deliver it to all the hospitals and the shut-in. And it's the consecrated elements.
It's the same elements. Precisely. It has to be. So that it comes from, so that there's a sense
of
it.
We have a whole service. I mean, they lead sure. them in prayer and pray Love together it. And receive the elements.
I may be on this Canterbury Trail any day now, the way we're going here.
It's very meaningful.
Excellent.
And if you know, some of these people are in assisted livings where they can't get out. And,
yep.
And some people, we've been doing this every Sunday with them for 2, 3, 4 years. It's very meaningful. And they feel so much connection.
They feel the connection.
To our community.
You bet. Sure. Yeah, what I do is I read the text that was either preached or, in the case of the lectionary, one of those texts. They don't give them the whole sermon. They don't want all that. Read the text and then celebrate the Eucharist with them. And then, so please.
One last comment.
No.
On the frequency question.
Please.
There's a historical detail in there that I think would probably blow most people's minds away. Why did we inherit a quarterly practice that became so frequent in the Protestant churches, especially in this country? It came from Zwingli in Geneva, who simply adopted the existing custom in Geneva because it happened that they had more frequent practice of communion than practically anybody else. Mm-hmm. So they were more spiritual than everybody else. And they happened to have two patron saints. So whenever they celebrated the feasts of those patron saints, it was the custom in the churches for everyone to receive communion, which was radical in that case. And Zwingli was, in that case, actually more in favor of more frequent than the average. Mm-hmm.
ironically.
But he wasn't in favor of weekly.
He was certainly
not. No, because he used the word too popish.
That's right.
It's too popish. We can't live with this, so we have to be...
I blame the Scots. So you might blame the Swiss, but it was the Swiss through the Scots and the Scottish Presbyterians that eventually led it to this continent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hebrews 4.
Hebrews 4.
Hebrews 4, 16.
Yes.
Are you suggesting that's an invitation to the table?
Who? I actually preached Hebrews 4, 16 at the General Assembly of the Christian Missionary Alliance this summer and preached it as, receive mercy in our time of need.
Because that's, I mean, you're framing that.
But there's no doubt that that was in the back of my mind, if not in the front of my mind. But pardon me?
That's what I was curious, and that's where I see
this. It's interesting because I'm curious if the language that I was using this morning was shaped by that sermon.
Absolutely.
But what I was trying to do in the sermon was to capture, because the genius of the text is that it's the ascended Christ that we are coming to. So we come into the presence of Christ and find mercy in our time of need. The reference to the Eucharist is not explicit, but it's obviously an apt text for the occasion of the celebration of the Lord's Supper. I want to come back to something as I conclude here that I mentioned earlier on in passing, but now want to make more explicit. That when we're talking about grace in our time of need, Hebrews chapter 4, 14 through 16, when we're talking about food for the journey, bread from heaven, living water, we necessarily need to talk about what I referenced earlier on, and that is the question of the disposition that we bring to the table. What is the disposition of heart with which we come? And for me, it has been represented of late in the image that I mentioned yesterday of my granddaughter coming to the altar in an Anglican church and not being able to receive because of their practices, but crossing her arms in her way of knowing that that's the way that she would request the blessing. And her disposition was quintessentially what I think Jesus is speaking of, is that we all come as children. We come with a childlike meekness, a childlike faith, a childlike dependency, such that it is appropriate. I'm not questioning the value of sitting. I'm not questioning the value of standing when I receive the elements. But there's something powerful about kneeling and about where I don't take the bread, but in my open hands, I receive the bread that is given to me. And I come there as the Reverend Dr. Gordon Smith, president of the university and the seminary. But at that moment, I am none of those. I am but a child of God. I am but a son of the living Father who has been called into his company. And now this one who is serving me is my spiritual father, who is Christ to me in that moment. That is, for me, the one who is serving me becomes Christ to me. They are the sacrament of Christ in that moment and beyond for what it's worth. But I receive with a meekness given by the Holy Spirit, I trust, the disposition of the grace that I receive is almost in direct proportion to the disposition that I bring to it. And that it behooves us then to foster the kind of humility that realizes we are not in control here. We are but children in need of grace. And I want to, my Stephen Covey comments earlier, I want to cultivate this kind of radical dependence. And to cultivate that kind of radical dependence means cultivating a radical disposition of humility. God grant me the grace. Mm-hmm.